Hello, everyone. It's Tom here. Before we get into another excellent episode of Last Orders, I just want to let you all know about Spike's 25th anniversary. Yes, we're celebrating our 25th birthday at the moment. And to celebrate, to mark this milestone, we're doing another donation drive to make sure that we're around for at least another 25 years fighting for freedom and democracy. We've also got a special offer on at the moment. So anyone who donates £25 or more to our anniversary donation drive can get a year's membership to Spike Supporters. That's our online donor community where you can come to exclusive events, read the Spike website completely free of ads and much more. That's half what you usually pay. So if you'd like to benefit from this offer, go to spiked-online.com/donate and make your £25 donation. If you can't afford that, anything you can give is hugely appreciated. Also, if you're already a Spike supporter and you want to benefit from this offer, make your £25 donation and we'll extend your membership by a year. Once again, that's spiked-online.com/donate. Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host, Christopher Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Bit ill, to be honest. Tom, in the dry cough stage of a cold, so excuse me if I start coughing.
Not at all, but I heard you've been on a particular form of sort of home cure at the moment.
Been drinking a lot of Guinness, if that's right, yeah. If you cut me, I bleed black.
This is the most on-brand thing Snowden has done in a while. Walked in and said that he's trying to get over his illness by drinking excessive amounts of Guinness.
Might have slowed down my recovery, but it's been all right.
We're also joined by another Guinness fan, I understand, Will Yarwood from the Taxpayers Alliance. How are you doing, Will?
I'm very well, Tom. Thanks for having me, fellas. I'm looking forward to this. I've also been drinking a lot of Guinness recently, but apparently that's a Gen Z thing that we don't really drink like craft beers and also rubbish beers, but we're really into Guinness, so much so that there was actually a Guinness shortage around Christmas, I believe.
Mm. And that was all young people's doing.
That was all my fault, yeah.
Exactly. Are you a Zoomer?
I'm a Zoomer. I'm 99, yeah. So Zoomer is 97.
You're 99? That's the greatest generation, surely.
Yeah, no. Yeah, we are the greatest generation.
Silent generation.
Silent generation. Yeah, 1999.
Oh, boy.
It starts at 97, and then it goes to like the early 2010s, and now you've got Gen Alpha after that, but we don't know much about.
Are we going back to Z?
Yeah.
Sorry, A, I mean.
Are you going back to A? Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So.
Good. Well, I mean, I think we discussed before, haven't we, about why Guinness is so popular and my theory about it.
I can't remember.
Because everyone's sick of craft beer. Everyone's seen through the scam of craft beer. And yet, a lot of pubs have not caught up with this. And so you go into a pub and you look at the range of so-called beers. You go, nothing here for me. Might as well have a Guinness. Because they'll always serve Guinness. Except in Sam Smith's.
They have their own that they're trying to push.
Yeah, some dodgy stout. Yeah,
absolutely. So that's the Guinness portion of the podcast completed. Let's also talk about one of the big issues in America at the moment, but is also having a knock-on effect over here as well, which is the topic of government waste, of government spending, of aid as well. I mean, ever since Trump's came back into power and he appointed Elon Musk as the head of this new Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, so-called, has been going through the books of various American departments, and particularly will the kind of USA programs come under a lot of scrutiny.
There's been
stories of, you know, transgender operas in Latin America being funded by the US taxpayer, and most recently, probably most amusingly, is Rory Stewart's wife's charity.
You're gonna say that
Turquoise Mountain, being deprived of its $1 million a year as part of this cult. Famous, of course, because of the fact that this was the charity that was teaching Afghan women about Marcel Duchamp, rather than actually dispensing aid in any usual sense. But Will, do you think this is an encouraging sign of where things are going, not just in US politics, but over here in terms of the question of government waste? I mean, you are from the Taxpayers Alliance.
Yeah, I mean, so my answer is probably going to be quite obvious, isn't it? But yeah, no, I think it's really, really positive. I think the way that Elon and Trump have come in and actually shown how dedicated they are to this, and this wasn't just a, you know, campaign talking line. They're actually installing Elon as the head of DOGE right now, and he's appearing beside the president during press conferences, during media interviews to actually talk about what they're going to be taking away, and actually, you know, potentially giving back to American taxpayers. There was a discussion actually that Elon's considering giving $5,000 back to every American taxpayer by the money he saved, which would be quite interesting. But yeah, it's had ramifications in the UK. We've had lots of great people, you know, spring up to talk about this kind of stuff. Charlotte Gill, obviously running a fantastic Substack on woke waste. Guido doing a little bit of work on this as well. The Spectator jumping into the conversation. And of course, the Taxpayers Alliance. I mean, we've been around for 20 years and been talking about it for 20 years. But it could feel quite lonely sometimes talking about government waste, because often people would say, oh, you know, there's nothing really you can do. You're talking about minute figures, you know, talk about something more important and more grand and more policy wonkish, let's say. But the fact that it's now come into discussion is fantastic. I'm really, really hopeful about it in the US, but I'm less hopeful about it in the UK. I mean, Rachel Rees, before she was Chancellor, she did talk about Tory waste quite a lot, you know, whether it's the PPE stuff or, you know, the flights on private jets and the helicopters and things like
COVID
that.
COVID app.
Yeah, yeah.
£37 billion
It's a lot of money. It's tons. And when Rees talked about that before she became Chancellor, we were very positive at the TPA saying, oh, Rees wants to declare a war on waste. This is great. Has she? No. Immediately, which is perhaps not a massive surprise. But there's a slight disconnect. Well, of course, the US now has a pretty, you know, focused right-wing government which wants to deal with this, while in the UK we have a centre-left government who's not at all. So it's up to organisations like the Taxpayers Alliance, up to individuals and journalists to do this work for them, so that hopefully we can set the groundwork for something like that in 2029, if not further along the line.
And what's interesting as well is that both with the Doge thing phenomenon, but also you could say the same about Javier Milei kind of taking his chainsaw to various departments in,
quite literally,
in Argentina. the way in which the question of the size of the state, or at least the question of waste, becoming actually a quite popular, even almost populist issue.
Yes.
Which I think kind of underscores something, which is that generally speaking, I think a lot of people, certainly in the UK, are quite comfortable with the government spending money, providing services, probably more so than either you two gentlemen would be. But at the same time, no one wants the government to be funding the Ethiopian Spice Girls or whatever. Like, or surely, like, there's no contradiction.
Yeah. No, quite. I mean, we had a front page just with The Sun the other day where the headline was amusingly Wokey Cokey, because it was revealing that UKRI, which is the UK Research Innovation Quango, which funds a lot of research projects in universities, we found out that they'd been funding a study into the ontology of TikTok dancing. £200,000, ladies and gentlemen, of your cash has gone towards that, which is absolutely fantastic. And obviously,
it's so expensive to study the ontology.
I know. TikTok, I mean, you know,
sure,
I
you just need a TikTok account and too much time on your hands.
Yeah, exactly. You know, just doom scroll. Just that's what I do. You know, I'll do it for free. but yeah, people do get rightly annoyed about this kind of stuff. But as I said earlier, people still have this slight aversion to talking about minute figures like that, because they'll fold their arms and they'll say, oh, well, actually, you need to be talking about more important issues rather than just this. But actually, this is an important issue, right? You know, when people get elected as MPs and as politicians, you know, none of them run on a platform of, I'm going to send a ton of your money to study TikTok dancing. Yeah. I'm going to send a ton of it abroad to, you know, for Ugandan climate aid. You know, if politicians stood on that platform, they wouldn't get elected. They wouldn't get votes. But a lot of the time, you know, this type of stuff is pushed under the rug or is not concerned, doesn't concern people. But now, like you said, with Doge in the US, it's had a translation into the UK, and I think that's really positive. But we've got to keep hammering the drum, because as we know, things can go out of fashion really, really quickly. And the Taxpayers Alliance, like I said, have been talking about this for 20 years now, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it for 20 years more. But if there is some move, either in the Tory or Reform or the Lib Dems or Labour, whoever it is, to really crack down on this kind of stuff. Because actually, interesting, when you look at polling, Labour voters are very in favour of, like, slashing the size of the civil service. They're not in favour of, like, foreign aid generally. And actually, there's a very large section of the population that doesn't mind, like you said, spending on, you know, the National Healthcare Service, pensions, things like that. But when it comes to stuff that is seen as objectively insane, especially if it's sent abroad, they hate it. So actually, there's a very clear cross-party consensus to do something like this. But I don't think they will, because politicians, especially on the Labour Party side of things, and even on the Tory side of things, are obsessed with the idea of soft power. That actually sending hundreds of thousands of British taxpayers' cash abroad to countries to study Bangladeshi shrimp or give, you know, have transgender operas, like you said earlier, improves Britain's standing on the world stage.
And Chris, we'd be remiss if we didn't dwell on Rory Stewart's wife, Shoshana Stewart, I should say. That as an example of just how bad. It's not even a question of it being perfect, waste. It's a sort of racket, isn't it?
Yeah,
kind of
exactly.
Type of upper middle class person to be able to run organisations and keep themselves in the lifestyle to which they become accustomed at the taxpayers' expense. Meanwhile, seemingly not doing. I'm sure they do some good work on the ground, but surely if you're wasting time talking about, you know, modernist art installations to Afghan women, your priorities are a bit screwed up.
Well, it's called Turquoise Mountain. for a start. So I don't think they're probably doing that much.
Set up by the King instead.
I don't want to judge a book by its cover, but it's run by Rory Stewart's wife and called Turquoise Mountain. I think it might be a bit of a money pit myself. I mean, it's just so funny. It's so predictable in a way. We should have sort of seen this coming, that if anyone was going to be involved in this, yeah, it'd be Rory Stewart's family. I mean, Rory Stewart is such a kind of hilarious and yet tragic case study of entitlement and sort of what you need to say and do in the modern world in order to fit in. Mm-hmm. And he's so desperate to fit in.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. He'll say anything to fit in. I think he might be a sociopath, potentially. and so he should have, firstly, he shouldn't have mentioned this, right?
Yeah.
At a time when all these scroungers who are getting money from USAID and, yeah, these other agencies trying to make out, oh God, this means that there's going to be malnutrition in Africa and all this. And Rory Stewart comes straight out and goes, oh, it's absolutely appalling. I mean, I was still owned. She's still owed $1 million. Just went just like that. There's nothing you can do.
Talk about the contract.
I mean, firstly, brilliant. That's how it went. Like, no warning whatsoever. Just, you're out.
Yeah, yeah.
But certainly, don't mention it, really. You're not helping the cause at all, yeah, by admitting that, you know, a couple of poshos who already, I mean, he makes something like £70,000 a month, doesn't he, from that ridiculous podcast. He's exactly the kind of person you'd expect to be involved in some of this. And I disagree with Will, actually. I don't think these sums are that small, and clearly in America they're not the small.
No,
right?
Not at all. Yeah.
But we'll never know because it's unfathomably large.
Yeah, yeah.
This huge sort of client state, and it is, like you say, Tom, a racket.
Yeah.
And I really hate it. Back when Will was a little boy, I wrote a series of papers called around the theme of sock puppets, and yeah, that was restricted just to government-funded pressure groups.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It mainly in public health, mm-hmm, and in environmental groups as well. It was quite narrow, but it was still an incredible amount of money.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
even that, I couldn't kind of find them all. I could only find some examples. And I looked at some of these organizations the other day to see if they're still getting money from the EU, and they are, even more than ever. And it's, you mentioned, what is it, UK HRI?
Yeah, UKRI, yeah.
That's,
yeah,
a good example. Nesta is a good example.
Yes.
There are loads of these sort of umbrella, well, the funding groups, aren't they, basically?
They're quangos,
they're,
yeah, yeah.
They're sort of like public sector trusts.
Yeah, yeah.
And they dish money out,
yeah,
to people that they like, essentially. Yeah. And it's the same with all the departments, Department of Health, Department of Education. They just give money to people that they're mates with. Now, imagine, rather than having this kind of sham democracy that we live in, we just had a king. We just had an absolute monarch or an emperor or something, right? And he did the same as what these scumbag politicians just loot us constantly for all the money they can get. But then just openly gave money to his cronies.
Yeah.
These people he liked. Somebody turns up, go like, oh, I'd like to, you know, I want to clamp down on mead consumption. And the king goes, yeah, I don't like mead either. Here, have some gold sovereigns. Yeah. Go on, let's take it off. You
I like
go.
You're really running with this theme.
Show,
I like
show
it.
Me no, well, it, people would, if that was the case, people would go, this is obviously corrupt. This is wrong.
Yeah.
Right? But because we have this, you know, veneer of, oh, these are stakeholders. These are NGOs,
yeah, yes,
you know.
Yes, yes.
And these are government agencies. It's all part, and it helps soft power abroad and all this rubbish, you know. People kind of go along with it. It's absolutely appalling, and it would be well worth somebody trying to emulate Musk, because you could save a lot of money. But more importantly, you could put a lot of useless people out of work and hopefully move them into the productive economy.
Absolutely. Reallocate resources in various different senses. And of course, it's not as if a lot of these people who are running these NGOs and non-profits and things, you know that they're doing this. It's just the fact that when you add it all up, they're having no discernible impact on the ground. The idea that all of these almost kind of arts and cultural projects in parts of the developing world are going to help them turn the corner and become prosperous.
No, it's just because we're producing too many arts and humanities.
They've got to go somewhere.
Got to go somewhere, and they feel entitled to some money. Yeah. And they're not going to get it through private industry, so they have to go cap and hand to the government. And too many people in the government, mainly bureaucrats, I would say. I mean, politicians aren't signing these things off knowingly. They go, yeah, cool, I like, you know, transgender theatre or whatever it may be. This has actually come up recently at the EU level, because the EU is even worse than the UK government. It's just ridiculous how much money they will give to anybody who will parrot words like, you know, civil society and, you know, anything to do with EU integration, active citizenship and all these stupid buzzwords the EU uses. They throw money at all sorts of people, in particular environmental groups. And this has come up in Brussels in the last few months. People have finally got wind of just how much money the European Commission is giving environmental groups to try and push the EU in an even more nuts net zero by next Tuesday kind of direction, right? And it's all designed to move the Overton window. And the justification these Eurocrats have is, oh, we get lobbied a lot by, you know, the oil companies and stuff, so we need to fund Friends of the Earth so they can lobby us. Well, firstly, you don't actually need much money to lobby someone, right? If an MEP wants to hear from Friends of the Earth, maybe we could allow some, you know, train ride as expenses. Mm-hmm. You don't actually need to give them millions of dollars to do it. Lobbying is a pretty simple process. It's just about getting access in the first place. They're not primarily being paid to lobby. They're being paid to change public opinion, which is a completely different thing. These people are cheerleaders, effectively, for government policy, with the strategy of, we'll go even more extreme, and that will make the government's position, which is actually pretty extreme itself, look moderate. It's a racket. It's undemocratic. It's wasteful. It's everything that's wrong.
Yeah.
And arguably a lot of this stuff is actually, if you look on the kind of international level of this, it's clearly counterproductive because of the kind of projects that are being funded, things like climate projects. It's all about depressing development in those places effectively, you know, and the general kind of government posture of many Western governments, which is that trying to dissuade developing countries from exploiting their own fossil fuel resources, whatever, the things that could actually be the building blocks of prosperity that would move through society, allow people to have more time so they can appreciate Marcel Duchamp or whatever else it is they want to do.
Do you know how these people describes anybody who was complaining about this racket? Never guess. Far right.
Oh, what a surprise.
This is how democracy dies. This is how these people behave.
Yeah.
It's like, what? If you take away my grant, democracy is going to die.
No, it only makes sense they've decided that they are democracy in any attack.
Yeah. Because there's a moral element to it. And Chris mentioned about the Overton window there. A lot of the reason this net zero stuff, this woke stuff gets pushed through is because it has oxygen. And that oxygen is taxpayers' cash, right? If you strip this money away from these things, they won't exist. They'll just cease to exist. They'll disappear into thin air.
Well, actually, funnily enough, that's not even true. Because there are a huge number of like private foundations and people like Dale Vince,
that's true,
who actually will give them money. So it's not even that they actually need this money from the taxpayer. People could easily step in with other things. Same with USAID. I'm sure there are good things that USAID do, right?
Yeah.
And the people who run it are going to push them to the fore and kind of distract your attention from all the enormous amount of bureaucracy and waste and daft projects that it's funding. But somebody can step in. If these are genuinely good causes, Mike Bloomberg or Bill Gates or all sorts of people could step in, or indeed other member states. And I dare say Keir Starmer will be dipping his hand in our pockets again to try and make up the shortfall from some of this.
It's about soft power.
Especially now the US has left the WHO.
Absolutely. He seems to want to be the kind of funder of last resort.
Soft power, mate. It's all about soft power. Britain has unparalleled soft power. People in other countries laughing up their sleeves.
So soft you can barely feel it.
Billions has to go to global quangos, otherwise Britain just won't have a seat at the table, you know. Actually, the average member of the British public doesn't care about any of this stuff. And actually, it only exists in the minds of like entitled politicians. You think these words really matter, and they've only been told they matter because of the sort of client managerial state that they live in. So you know, Trump and Elon Musk with Doge taking a hammer to all of this should signal an end to that kind of stakeholderism and that kind of managerialism. But again, with Doge and Trump specifically, it takes a lot of will and a lot of energy and desire to do something like this. And that's what we're missing a little bit in the UK, is the sort of willpower and the ability to, like, let's just do something. Because also the issue in the UK, unlike in the US to some extent, is, although the US has a large and expanding bureaucracy and quangocracy, in the UK, often you have civil servants who will talk to ministers, and ministers will say, oh, you know, I'd like to do this, I'd like to do X, Y, and Z. And they'll, you know, tap on their computer and say, computer says no. Computer says no, we can't do that, minister, I'm afraid. Sorry, we can't do that. Because they don't have any idea of where sort of the power nodes are. They can't really move things around. You know, is Parliament sovereign, or is the judiciary more sovereign than Parliament at the moment? Is this, you know, given to a quango? Does this minister or secretary of state have control over anything? You know, the real question is, who governs Britain, right? And in the US, Trump and Milan are saying, no, we're in charge, we're governing Britain. And we need the same kind of discussion here in the UK, where politicians say, actually, it's us, it's politicians, it's the Parliament that is sovereign and is able to make these decisions, not activist lawyers, not quangocrats, not civil servants and so on and so forth. But again, it takes a lot of will, takes a lot of energy, and I just don't quite see that at the moment from our political class.
The Taxpayers' Alliance doesn't get any grants from the government, is it?
No, no,
That'd be very funny.
Zero.
Just to be clear.
While you're doing your war on waste. Daily Mail does a splash on the taxpayer waste. It's you and John O'Connell drinking claret in Boysdale.
Don't worry, Chris. It's all dark money.
Same with the IA. We never take that.
We
government grant, never will.
We refused to take COVID furlough. We refused to take it because we thought it was immoral to take taxpayers' cash. We refused to take any money off any government at all because it's
apart from the Russian government.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, naturally.
Foreign governments.
Naturally, you know, start sweating. but yeah, it's a principle that we hold and we're quite proud of it. And we managed to survive easily throughout COVID thanks to the generous nature of our donors and our supporters. But yes, I mean, the when you look at the you know, how leftists talk about our groups, you know, who funds you? Actually, we should do like an Uno reverse card. Actually, who funds you? And actually, you peel the back and it's like, oh, it's the taxpayer. It's UK aid, it's US aid. And actually, you're a complete waste of money and you need the funding immediately. It's not us that has all this dark money in the background. Yeah. Actually, it's you lot. And actually, it's significantly worse because it's money stolen off of plumbers and bar staff and ordinary hardworking people. It's not voluntarily given as taxes aren't. So yeah, it's actually significantly worse when they do it. You know, hypocrisy folds arms. But yeah, I think that the energy in the UK still needs to come. But I'm slightly hopeful that there are a few people talking about it now. And actually, hopefully that voice will get louder and louder and louder. And more politicians will start to talk about this. But then where the politicians do anything about this, we don't know. I mean, Osborne and Cameron back in 2010, when I was all but 10 years old, they used to talk about a bonfire of quangos. But actually what they did is they turn smaller quangos into bigger quangos. And 8 out of 10 quangocrats kept their jobs. Mm-hmm. And there was no real reduction in the size of the quangocrat state.
Hasn't Rachel Reeves, I just remembered, hasn't she set up some sort of Department of Government Efficiency?
Oh, she set up the Office for Value for Money. Ran by a guy who was never
running
HS2. Ran the parliamentary refixing committee to try and like fix Parliament. So he's never run an efficient project in his life. Every single project.
It's like this government is being run by like a kind of right wing newspaper satirist.
Like
every turn is full of this. It's either Sue Gray or it's someone who's backstory is completely resolved. We could talk about how terrible this government is for a long time, but Chris, should we talk about how terrible the Welsh government is specifically?
yeah.
Because I know you've been dipping back into the question of minimum pricing there, but also just how the state, you know, the kind of state of the place in general seems to be deteriorating under terrible Labour rule for quite some time.
Terrible Labour rule. So they've got 20-mile-hour zones pretty much everywhere. There was a petition signed by nearly 500,000 people. Well, given that Wales has a population of 3 million people, that's quite a significant contribution, saying, can you get rid of this? It's unbelievable. We're not talking like near schools or right in the middle of cities. We're talking about country lanes, aren't we? Yep. Some of them. And the Welsh government ignored that. But then there was a petition signed by about 37,000 people saying, let's ban greyhound racing. And they've done that.
Yep.
They just announced that this week. They're going to ban greyhound racing under pressure, interestingly, from both the animal rights and the anti-gambling lobby. I'm not sure which was more persuasive in that particular instance. But so they're going to do that. And they brought in minimum pricing back in 2020. During lockdown, which I guess stopped some people crossing the Severn Bridge to go to the Asda just on the other side. but it didn't last forever. And as in Scotland, I believe it had a sunset clause, which is one of the things that the politicians use to trick people into voting with these things. Go like, you know, oh, if it doesn't work, boy, you know, we'd get rid of it. And
diabolical.
Diabolical.
and as in Scotland, it didn't work, but politicians said it did, so they've kept it. But in Wales, even more obviously than in Scotland, it didn't work. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've read the official evaluation, and the people who wrote it clearly can't believe that it works because it's all about the unintended consequences, or very predictable unintended consequences. People are drinking more vodka, people are beating their wives, people are stealing to buy money for to get money for booze. People are going to the pub less and drinking more at home. Every single predictable and consequence. People take more drugs. All of them have come to pass. Everything that people like me said will happen if you bring in this boneheaded policy have happened. And then right at the end of the evaluation, it says, like, on balance, it works. It's like, what? The deaths have got alcohol-specific, what they call alcohol-specific deaths. So these are not things like the handful of cancers that are supposed to be linked to drinking, but things or drownings are things where, you know, they just arbitrarily say 20% of drownings are drink related. Well, I mean, like liver cirrhosis and alcohol poisoning and things like that. They rose more in Wales than any other part of the UK during COVID. They went up everywhere, because it turns out that, you know, forcing people to stay at home with nothing to do will lead some people to drink themselves to death.
Shocker.
Stay at home, protect the NHS, drink yourself to death. And those figures still haven't really come down. But of all the home nations, it's gone up more in Wales than anywhere else. And it's gone up more than England, which is your obvious control group in this. You know, so it, by any reasonable measure, like in terms of absolute number of deaths, in terms of relative to England or anywhere else, it's obviously failed. And then you've got this evaluation showing it's failed. And, in fact, I've got to read this out. This is the quote of the bloody year so far, right? it's an amazing thing. So this is from a piece in The Conversation, which is a mostly kind of pop science kind of thing, where researchers summarise their work. And the authors of the Welsh evaluation wrote an article which didn't mention alcohol-related deaths at all. It just said, oh, consumption's gone down, which it probably did, or sales at least, probably has gone down because people are buying their drink in the west of England. The gist of it was, the minimum pricing still has its critics, particularly among people who point to the actual number of alcohol-related deaths in Wales. And they left it at that. They didn't explain what that meant exactly, but there was a strong enough hint to someone who's not familiar with the evidence that maybe alcohol-related deaths have gone through the roof, which indeed they have.
That's right up there with the NHS is great at many things apart from keeping people alive.
Yeah. Very similar, yeah. A nod and a wink there.
Yeah. Incredible. Will, what do you make of time and again, it seems like things like minimum pricing have just proven to be ineffective, yet they cling on to them.
Right? Yeah, of course they do. Of course they cling on to them because they have an ideology which, you know, believes in it, and they're also all mates with, you know, anti-alcohol lobbyists. I saw you posted on X, Chris, there's a new person at the Department for Health who used to work for, was it Alcohol UK or something, was it called?
Alcohol Change UK. Which used to be known as Alcohol Concern.
Right, and, that's just proving that actually...
The policy lead as well.
Yeah,
is the policy lead for the Department of Health for alcohol and gambling. And a few weeks ago, she was the policy lead for an explicitly anti-alcohol temperance group, basically. Why is there even a policy lead at the Department of Health for gambling?
Won't be the only one inside the civil service exactly like that. I bet there's plenty at the Department for Health.
Aren't politicians supposed to be the policy leads?
Yeah, well,
they're supposed to be the one who come with the policies, and then you give them to the civil servants, and they implement them, not the other way around.
Who governs Britain? And then not politicians, and certainly not us. It's all civil service at the moment, and the activists inside of it. But unfortunately, I did live and grow up in the People's Republic of Wales, in northeast Wales, for most of my life. One thing I did notice, it was actually, even though Wales does have Puritan strand to it, mainly because of its Methodist and old Liberal Party inheritance, they really were in favour of, licensing laws. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a funny story from when licensing laws were introduced in Wales, and actually there's a street where one side is Wales and one side is England, and actually the pub would shut earlier in Wales on one side, so everyone from that pub would just jump over the other street and go to the pub across the road in England.
Similar situation with minimum pricing.
Similar situation. obviously it's crazy, but again, my position on nanny state stuff, I'm not sure if Chris agrees with this, it's a rather unique take, is actually in order to resist nanny state stuff, you actually need to do more of what they hate more. So actually you need to drink more, you need to, you know, enjoy tobacco, you need to, you know, enjoy gambling, you need to do the things that they want to take away from you. But again, the British public, unfortunately, a lot of them, and a lot of the Welsh public as well, are actually genuinely pretty authoritarian on this stuff. I don't quite understand why. Maybe there's a deeper reason for it that maybe Chris can elucidate.
Because you've got loads of bloody state-funded pressure groups who are constantly in the media.
Do you think it's all
lying
down
about the scale of the problem, right, and the cost to the NHS? That's a lot.
So you think it's like a top-down, like propaganda, like effort?
Like we
basically
said before, these NGOs are there to change public opinion, and that is what they do by just hammering on and on and on. And then you get people like Chris Van Tulliken who just do it for the fun of it, and this it's scaring the hell out of people. So people are certainly, in the abstract, they are pro nanny state, and as long as it doesn't affect them, they are quite happy to see other people being punished. That's most obvious with smokers, but now increasingly with vapors. People are just going, oh, ban vaping or whatever. Well, wait, have you even thought this through? Does it even matter to you whether someone vapes? Do you know what I mean? The booze is the only one which kind of is a bit different. Well, I suppose obviously everybody eats food as well, don't they? but if you actually look at alcohol policy in England, obviously this is not true in Wales and Scotland, where they do have a bit more of a sort of Methodist kind of thing going on, a Presbyterian thing going on. But in England, even the Labour Party froze alcohol duty at the last budget, despite being desperate for money. They do know that anti-alcohol stuff is actually pretty unpopular. There was a brief thing, I don't remember, the former public health minister, Andrew Gwynn.
Ah, yes.
They come and go, don't they? He was reported to have said something at the Labour Party conference about we were going to shut the pubs earlier. And there was such an outcry.
Yes.
I think Starmer himself came out within hours ago. No, we're not doing this. Don't worry.
I need to pose in the Dog and Duck suddenly.
Although it's the banning smoking outside of pubs even. I remember when The Sun broke that story. And even we're not obviously sure if that was actual real policy, but the fact that Starmer had to come in front of a camera and say that's not happening, folks. So even there's a line for him and
for the
public, sector,
people,
and for the public, apparently, right? Where they're not, where they even without side smoking, they think because I do think that the division between when you're having beer gardens now, you have a division between a smoking area and a non-smoking area. I think that's a perfectly fine compromise, but nevertheless, I do get annoyed when there's not that division and you'll have people go to that beer garden and they'll tell you off for smoking outside or even vaping outside. I remember getting told off for vaping outside once. It was when I was at university.
A member of the public?
Yeah, a member of the public when I was at university, some local, who was like, which was obviously, I thought, mental. I thought it was absolutely insane. But I remember when I used to work in Parliament briefly, and I remember when Jeremy Hunt announced that he was going to ban disposable vapes, and there was obviously massive levels of cheering, pushed by actually one other than Dr. Caroline Johnson, of course, who is the arch nanny state MP who's obsessed with banning solar farms and banning vapes. That's her two main concerns.
She wants to ban solar farms.
She hates solar farms.
She hates technology.
Won't someone think of the children, Chris? What if they trip over a solar farm? But I remember that.
Bring back coal and cigarettes.
Bring back coal and cigarettes. Yeah, exactly.
Really? Just like burning things.
What the woke have taken away from us.
Also, like kids being on vapes is a relatively nice problem to have.
Yeah, exactly.
Because like, they're not smoking.
Yeah, they're not smoking. And like I said earlier, with Gen Z specifically, like they're not smoking at all and they're not even drinking all that much. Although one thing I do hear from my old university is actually nightclubs are having an issue because actually lots of young people just aren't staying out that long anymore. Mm-hmm. They're not bothering to go to clubs. Lots of pubs, which when they used to hold events for university students, they often gave them free because the amount of money they throw behind the bar and booze would be pretty insane. Now they charge upfront costs because students don't drink anymore.
If you don't drink, there's no point going to nightclubs.
Well, true. But
have you ever been to a nightclub sober? It's one of the worst experiences you can ever have.
Just going to a pub. I mean, it's
surreal.
It's crazy. I'm a little bit worried how we're going to be able to resist nanny state stuff in the future if we have even less people who are invested in doing the things that they want to take away from you.
Mm-hmm. Now, Will, this might seem a little bit off topic, but do you have any opinions about Lucy Letby?
Let's turn to Lucy Letby Corner. Lucy Letby Corner.
You don't have to comment. We don't have to do it. We should have asked you before.
I'll be honest with you, Chris. Like multiple things like that, I keep my nose very well away from it. Although I do know people who are firmly on either side of the Lucy Letby.
I know you work with a big Letby.
Big Letby truther. Big Letby truther. But I do. I'm not massively involved in it, but I do always tune in when you're debating either Hitchens or David Davis most recently about it. Why is Davis so interested in it? I'm not, because I know he's a civil liberties kind of guy, but he's really, really attached himself to this issue.
I couldn't possibly comment. Well, there's a school of thought that there's something about Lucy Letby that attracts thirsty old men, but I don't know if that's the case.
You wouldn't dare cast those aspersions in David Davis's direction.
So that's Lucy Letby Corner for the week. Tom,
conclude. Shall we go to our final question? You are a dictator. Will, as you may know on this podcast, because we are very libertarian and anti-ban, we ask our guests if they had to have one ban, what would it be?
Now, can I chip in with a couple first, briefly, while Will thinks about this? Just a couple of public transport things that annoyed me on the way here. Firstly, Victoria Station, which was needlessly redesigned at great expense for no point to it whatsoever. When I come from my home to London, Victoria, that is my final destination. Yep. I put my ticket in the machine. I expect it to keep the bloody ticket. which it always used to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And now, for some reason, it gives me it back. And I always forget, so the barriers don't open. I'm like, what? And then, oh God. And then I've got to, because there's no bins in train stations, because terrorists might put bombs in them, I have to carry around a ticket for the rest of the day. Now, you might say that's a first world problem, but I live in a first world country.
These are my problems.
Item two, also train related.
These are getting more and more minute, Darryl.
I know.
Well, the pettier the better, I think.
We've been doing it for years. I'm two. I got on the train today. I got the 11 o'clock morning train, right? Which you, on a Thursday, you think that's going to be quiet. That's going to be whole table to yourself scenario, generally speaking. Get to the platform, loads of people there. A lot of women and children. And I suddenly twigged. It's half term, isn't it? Everyone comes up to London with their kids at half term because they can't think of anything to do with them at home. And it's annoying. So my ban there, I suppose. Well, ideally, you'd have more carriages at half term. That was what the company should do. I suppose we could just ban women and children from public transport. Something for men only, I guess.
Sensible policies for a happy actually,
to give you a little bit more time to think, while I remember, because I'll forget otherwise, we've actually had some listeners send some in.
Oh, nice.
So one of which was via email. It's from Matthew Wilson. Hello, Matthew. I would ban flip-flops. They are evil. They should never be allowed in an office. I'm in Australia, and flip-flops, aka thongs are considered dress shoes by many Aussies. Also got one in person last night at the Free Speech Union anniversary do from Mark. Hello, Mark. Good to meet you. Who said he wanted to ban people from filming firework displays on their phones. Because he says that, like, of all the things to film irritatingly, like a gig or whatever, like, there's something particularly absurd about not watching the fireworks and filming it on your phone. So I thought that was quite a good one.
That's a good point, yeah.
But Will, now
also
you've had plenty of time.
People
to...
filming sports. People
filming
football. You see, like, you know, generally, I think tourists, taking a corner and you can see some little Japanese guy with his phone up. He's going, who's going to want to watch that?
The back
of a player. Precious
memories that they'll relive.
Or filming entire concerts from, like, miles away. Like, I don't understand that at all. But that's not a thing I'm banned. Mine's more avaricious and nasty, actually.
Lay it on me.
One thing, I work near the Home Office. In Westminster, and in the summer, often we see, you know, on the front when it's nice and sunny, lots of civil servants sitting around and having their, you know, having their hour long lunch break and, you know, enjoying their home packed lunch and going to Pret as they do and enjoying their, you know, nonsense whatever they buy from Pret. I've never been
sandwiches.
To Pret. Sandwiches.
It's
probably.
Not. To be fair, it's not even I go to Pret. It's not that pompous.
I think it is. We didn't have them in Wales.
He's down that pie and mash shop for lunch every day.
Yeah. We had a Tesco Express and that was it. I would, considering public sector productivity's on the floor, I actually think I would ban civil servants from having lunch. I think that
they're allowed to eat.
I think that's a fair compromise. I would prefer if they had just a few pints and a cigarette for lunch, personally. But I think that until public sector productivity gets off the floor, I would ban civil servants from having lunch, because there's nothing I hate more on the half an hour lunch that if I do take it, because sometimes I just skip lunch altogether and have a big dinner or whatever it might be. I see civil servants who've just spent their entire day in meetings or rubber stamping illegal immigrants to come into the country and giving them indefinite, you know, right to remain. You know, enjoying Ponzi lunches outside the Home Office, and it really, really irks me. So actually, that's the petty, nasty thing I would do. I say until public sector productivity gets under control, until your department gets under control, none of you are allowed to leave your desk for the 8 hours that you work here. You're allowed to eat. That's fine. You can eat at your desk.
Oh, they can eat at the desk. They can have lunch.
They can have lunch if they like.
They just can't do it where it's going to annoy you.
Yeah.
When you walk past them on the way to the kebab shop.
One, they can't take an hour.
We'll figure all these bits out in secondary legislation.
Yeah, one, they can't take an hour. And two, they can't, like, go out for lunch, right? They can't go out for lunch because that's time there where they could be actually delivering for hardworking British taxpayers. Yeah. You know, they're not on a building site, right? They don't need an hour for lunch to rest. You know, I'm sure it gets very hard.
Isn't there a case for saying the less they do, the better it is for the general public?
I don't necessarily agree with that per se, because there are some elements of the civil servant that do actually work and actually do what needs to be done. But I would fire quite a lot of them as well and reduce the size of the civil service quite dramatically. But that's, you know, that's my avaricious petty thing that I would do, is I'd ban civil servants from having lunch until public sector productivity gets off the floor, especially in the Home Office, mainly because it's what I see in the summer. Yeah.
Lunch is for wimps, not for civil servants.
Exactly, yeah.
Brilliant. Will, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders.
Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.